Okay, so I'd like to start by thanking the organizer for the invitation to give my talk on this exciting conference. And also, I'd like to start by acknowledging and thanking my collaborators, so in particular, my group at UCL, Alex and Gala mainly, who are the people who did most of the work which I'll be presenting. And my collaborator. So in the first part of my talk, I will show a work in close collaboration with experimental group of Daniele Sanvito, and in particular of two experiments led by Dario and Lorenzo. And special mention to Sebastian, because in the second part of my talk, I will actually talk about a work which we started together during the last KTP workshop on quantum fluids of light, and now it just came to the end, so we'll be submitting a paper together, hopefully, in the next few days, so it's a nice closure between these two programs. So we already know quite a lot about the systems after Sebastian talked, but in generally, what I'm interested here is looking at photonic systems and photonic systems. In photonic system, you always have it's naturally driven and dissipative, because even the best manufactured microcavities or any photonic cavities will have a finite lifetime. You cannot really capture photons. So in order to sustain some photons in the system, you need to have an external drive. So you have on one side, it's always two bath, really. It's never one, because the photons will always escape from the cavity. So you have your kappa decay, if you want. And then to sustain some excitations, you have to have external drive from the other side. So this is relevant to many experimental realizations. I will focus on microcavity polaritons in semiconductors, but the same can happen in other systems. You just need photons to interact via something. So in case of semiconductors, it interacts via exciton, but there also has been work on photon BEC in dye, where the photon interacts via molecular transitions. There are also works on circuit QD systems when the photons interact with Josephson junctions, and also there has been works on atoms in cavities where photons interact with the two-level states of atomic transition. So it's quite a wide range of problems which one can look. And in particular, the questions which I want to ask today are kind of on the two ranges of the spectrum. So first question is, despite this drive and decay, can we actually engineer a thermal equilibrium in the system? So everything is relative in life, and even if the photons escape from cavity and you have a finite lifetime, which is, in case of semiconductors, order of picoseconds, but if anything else in the system is happening much faster, you can actually, you can think of creating a thermal equilibrium system. Like in cold atoms, I mean, due to three body losses, the cold atom BEC is also not infinitely lived. So why would that be interesting? That would be interesting because if you can create a thermal equilibrium in your systems, you can really reach a ground state. You can use it for simulating other systems, or even you can think of using it for adiabatic quantum computing. And this is kind of easier than for atoms, because due to the photonic component, the mass of polaritons is much lighter. So the temperature which you need to have any quantum effects are much higher. So your experiments are probably one order of magnitude simpler and one order of magnitude cheaper than that for ultra-cold atoms. So if we can achieve thermal equilibrium in this system, it can be useful. On the other hand, is that these systems are intrinsically driven. So we don't want to limit ourselves only to, okay, we create a thermal equilibrium and that's it. We also want to look at out of equilibrium phenomena. And in particular, the other questions I want to ask is, okay, let's say we go out of equilibrium, but we don't want to be just a little bit out of equilibrium. So the physics is like in equilibrium, but just with some small modification. We really want to go to non-trivial situations which don't exist in equilibrium, like what Sebastian was discussing. So in experiments, can you achieve this limit? And can we also go to really very far from equilibrium limit when non-trivial phases exist which don't have equilibrium counterpart? So just for those who don't know the field, this is not really a niche system at the moment. It's probably as active as cold atoms, following the fundamental works on condensation, superfluidity, vortices, and quantum turbulent pattern formation some years ago. Now the field is moving into kind of two complementary directions. One is to bring the system closer to application, so creating a strong coupling and polariton condensation and lasing via electrically pumped configuration, which will be very practically appealing. And on the other side, looking at different materials, and such as, for example, organic microcavities, where already condensation and superfluidity has been observed at room temperature. So now if you can combine these two together, you can actually have your polariton condensates in your pocket. And in another direction is similar to cold atoms, is looking at lattices and kind of more complex systems. And this has been already, there are probably five different ways of creating lattices, starting from early experiments on gold deposition and cervical acoustic waves, and then more recent realizations using etched micropillars, sub-wavelength grating, and pump modulation. So if you look at what has been already achieved, so quite a lot has been achieved in the context of topological matter, edge state, spin orbit coupling, Dirac cones, magnetic monopoles, this has all been realized, and also first realizations and first works on simulating Bose-Hubbard and NXY Hamiltonians, and probably a lot more, which I don't mention everything which has been done here. But taking a step back, this system has this intrinsic drive dissipation nature as what we had before. So we can ask a question, what type of condensate? Like before putting lattices, before putting complication, we can ask a question, what type of condensate is here and how much is equilibrium and how much is out of equilibrium? So what can we have in 2D? I mean, these systems are two-dimensional. All of these photonic systems are two-dimensional. You need to lose one dimension because you need to trap photons. So you could think of a finite-size Bose-Einstein condensate. You can think of the BKT transition in two-dimension. And then recently, what has been discussed just before, one can think of more exotic type of superfluidity, KPZ, of a KPZ type, or perhaps nothing is possible, perhaps always the disorder phase wins in this non-equilibrium context. So the question is, what is really the true in current experiments, or what is possible to realize in the future experiments? And in particular, what is important to notice here, that there is an interplay between two different things. There is an interplay between drive, dissipation, and non-equilibrium. So this drive and dissipation pushes us towards non-equilibrium physics. But actually, finite size and spatial inhomogeneity is pushing us towards equilibrium. And so there is an interplay between the two, and how important it is, I will discuss in this talk. So going back one step before the kind of KPZ era, if you just look at in a kind of simpler way, so just from the point of view of spin wave, or just like if you just consider the smooth collective wave, collective fluctuations without vortices and without this KPZ correction, what you get is if you combine these three different aspects of the problem, so dimensionality, we are dealing with two-dimensional problem, but we are dealing with a driven dissipative problem where the collective modes in the system are diffusive, not linear, like in case of Bogoliubov, and the occupation is non-thermal. However, if you just look at what would be the order in the system. So let's say you go, there is some kind of phase transition. I mean, that's for sure what's happening in experiments and what you would expect. There is some phase transition between order and disorder. And if you want to look at the order part and you want to compute G1, you want to compute the first order correlations, you actually find, if you do it even in this non-equilibrium context, you actually find that your in that regime, your correlations are algebraic. However, so in some sense, you can think about it if you neglect KPZ correction. So by KPZ corrections, you have to understand that you are taking a phase fluctuations to all orders, but gradients of the phase fluctuations only to the first order. then you obtain a kind of algebraic decay of correlations. So in some sense, you could define your temperature, because if my first order coherence decays algebraically, although the system is out of equilibrium, so the modes are diffusive and the occupation is non-thermal, I can always define the temperature by just redefining this alpha. However, there is already difference already at that level between equilibrium, full equilibrium system, and this kind of non-equilibrium but behaving like equilibrium system is the difference between time and space correlation. So in case of this driven system, there is a factor of two difference between the algebraic decay in space and algebraic decay in time. And one can derive this coefficient via complicated Kaldish field theory, but you can just naively, without even doing this calculation, guess because how space and time relate in the excitation spectrum. So normally, in case of closed system, you have a linear dependence, so these coefficients will be the same. But here, you have a diffusive behavior, so the real part goes to zero, but the imaginary part goes like 1/k². So that's why you have one half. So you already see a difference between equilibrium and non-equilibrium already on this very simple level. So now the next step is, of course, to consider vertices. So with vertices, we'll have an upper bound on these exponents because there will be a costless Taylor transition. So you don't get algebraic decay with any coefficients. There is an upper bound which is 1/4, indeed you can show it. So either you can basically solve the equations which Sebastian was explaining numerically, which then, if you do it numerically, you include both the smooth degree of freedom of phase fluctuations and vortices, and one can actually show that in the system, if the system is not equilibrated, this exponent crosses the upper bound, so it can be larger than an equilibrium upper bound. In the numerics, we obtain values as large as 1.4, which is more or less four times, even more than four times the equilibrium upper bound. And in the past experiments, 2012 experiments of Yamamoto group, they also found a power law decay of coherence with exponents which are much larger. So in some sense, what do you have? You have an overshaken superfluid. So the difference between equilibrium superfluid and this driven dissipative superfluid is very small. You still have algebraic decay of coherence. The only difference is that the space and time decay of correlation do not match, and the upper bound for the alpha exponent is now much larger. So the system is still superfluid, but it can support a higher level of phase fluctuations. So just to remind, in equilibrium closed system, the algebraic decay in space and algebraic decay in time will have exactly the same exponent given by temperature over density, and you'll have an upper bound for that. So already on this level, one can distinguish the two systems, and the holy grail in the Polariton community was to first actually achieve that. So we can achieve that first, and that will be the starting point to look at any non-equilibrium or more complicated phenomena. And this has been done only very recently, so that's actually thanks to Lauren Pfeiffer and Ken West samples, which are studied in David Snoke and Daniele groups. So these were particularly good quality samples, which allow very long polariton lifetime. So this is more or less one order of magnitude longer than the previous microcavities. And they were at the same time very spatially homogeneous. So now you can drive your condensate, and then it expands. But because it expands, but it has a very long lifetime, it actually thermalizes and equilibrates much faster than any non-equilibrium effects. Now you can measure coherence. You can interfere the area you take the light from microcavity, and then you can just interfere with itself. So you make a mirror image, and you can measure coherence here, and you can characterize this coherence as a function of distance between points. So this is experimental data, and what they see is as you increase the density in your system, here you cannot easily change the temperature. What you are changing is always the density of particles. You just increase your drive. So you could see that you go from from a fast decay in space, from exponential decay to an algebraic, to a very clear algebraic decay over quite a large distance. This is of the order of 70 micrometers via some stretch exponential. And then they measured exactly the same in time, and the very similar behavior has been seen in time correlation. So above certain threshold, you see a clear algebraic decay of space and time correlations. And now if you feed that to a power law, the main point was that you could see this coefficient of the algebraic decay being exactly the same for space and time and smaller than one-fourth. So that was a clear indication that you really see a kind of equilibrium type of BKT physics here. So just to check whether this all makes sense, and moreover, on the experimental from experimental point of view, you cannot really see, you don't have a direct access to vortices because the experiments are always average over multi-realizations. It's always nice to look theoretically whether what they observe is what you really expect if you take similar parameters into your model. So starting from this equation, which has been described by Sebastian, that basically this boils down to having a polariton field with some mass, some polariton-polariton interaction, drive and decay, and the saturation of the drive and the noise trend, which you can derive either from Kelder's field theory via MSR formalism or from Fokker-Planck equation by neglecting the first order derivative term. So for those who know truncated Wigner method, so it's basically you can do both ways depending whether you come from condensed matter or quantum optics community. And if we now take parameters which are the same as experimentally, most of the parameters are null, we can actually get a very similar behavior. So going from exponential via stretch exponential to a power law decay. And moreover, for this sample, we can, that's just a technical details that sometimes instead of this very simple saturation effects in the Hamiltonian, one can put a more elaborate nonlinear drive, which is kind of slightly closer to experimental, but it doesn't bring any difference for those calculations because the densities in these experiments were relatively low. So this is more kind of nonlinear drive. So what we obtain in this numerical analysis is that indeed you go if you start from lower density and you increase density, you will pass a threshold, and you go from exponential to algebraic decay. And moreover, for that parameters corresponding to the parameters of the system, you really go to the regime where the spatial and temporal coherence really do match. So this is a fit. This is an algebraic exponent of the space and time correlations, and they're exactly the same, and they're smaller than one-quarter. So if you now look at a single shot, because in the numerics, it is possible, of course, to look at the single shot images, and then you see that whenever you have algebraic decay, you really don't have any free vortices. So if the vortex and the red and the black is vortex anti-vortex, and this is just a little bit above the transition, and this is just a little bit below the transition. So whenever you have exponential or stretch exponential behavior of your correlation function, you see that you always have some free vortices. So this is coarse graining, meaning that I lose some resolution in space. I fully transform the image. I cut a higher k part, and then I fully transform back. So whenever I have a tightly bound vortex anti-vortex pair, I'm losing it. So I'm just trying to get free vortices. So whenever I have exponential or stretch exponential, I get a free vortices. And whenever I have algebraic decay, I don't have any free vortices. So basically, that's a kind of proof that we are seeing really BKT crossover and not any KPZ physics. Yeah, because KPZ physics would correspond to stretch exponential but without vortices. So that was just kind of an indication that we're really seeing a smooth crossover, because in the finite system, you never jump from exponential to algebraic decay. You have to go through something, and stretch exponential is a good function to go through. But it's also connected with the KPZ. But here, because of the behavior of vortices, we see it's not really a KPZ. That's just experimental proof that time and space are important. So you can take a laser, you can take a VCSEL, a very bad cavity system, And you can still, on a kind of small length scale, you can still recover algebraic decay. And this is because this is an extended system with lots of modes, and you can have the type of modes interactions which can lead to algebraic decay in space. But if you really have the algebraic order connected with the BKT transition, you should really observe algebraic decay both in space and time. And in this kind of laser sample, they only observe it in space, but not in time, showing that the both are important to actually have a clear evidence of equilibrium in the system. You can also look at from the point of view of the spectra. So if the system is driven, it has a diffusive spectra. Then, as you decrease the lifetime of, so you make the cavity better and better, you're becoming closer to equilibrium type of description where the modes are just linear. And the experimental spectrum is remarkably linear. So it shows that the drive and decay is not really important, and that's the theoretical spectra, computational spectra above the transition when you just see the lower polariton branch, and here when you see the Bogoliubov modes. So we can put a stamp that actually equilibrium-like behavior, despite this strong drive and dissipation, has been achieved in the system. And this has to be combined also with the previous work of David Snow, who is working with very similar sample grown by the same group. He was not observing the effects I talked here, but he was matching, he was collecting the luminescence and matching to the Bose-Einstein distribution and looking at a very good fit. So basically, it's another way of showing that you really reach the equilibrium physics here. Okay, so the first part, we can be happy that in this light matter system, you can, if your samples are good enough, you can achieve equilibrium, which can be useful for certain class of problems. However, the life is more complicated, as we heard before. If the samples are not so good, so you can go back to older experiments and try to look at samples which with much shorter lifetime, and especially if you go to larger and larger distances, we know that what we just described is not everything. We have this non-equilibrium KPZ non-linearity, and in fact, it would be interesting to actually see it. Yeah, I mean, it's something new. You still have superfluidity, but you don't have algebraic decay. So you have strict exponential decay of correlations, but still superfluidity survives. So it's something novel, something which does not exist in equilibrium. So it would be nice to look at that. Although, of course, there is this negative message a little bit in a way that that adding vortices actually destroys this KPZ superfluidity, if you want to call it. But there are ways around it. I mean, this is still a research in progress, so one cannot have a final word on that. But adding vortices can have a problem of activation. Whenever we run simulation, we see that, of course, vortex and anti-vortex are born together. They're always born together. And at short distances, they're attractive. So how to pull them apart? You know, maybe the system, and the same will happen in experiment. You switch on your experiment, and these are topological defects. You can't just create a vortex. It will be vortex, anti-vortex. And if at small distances, they're attractive, perhaps they will never go to these large distances, and you will never actually destroy your superfluidity. So actually, it might not be so bad. That's one way of looking at this. Another way is that, of course, this non-superfluidity message is only in the system which are isotropic. So now if you go to a systems which are anisotropic, so if you introduce some spatial anisotropy to your system, it can happen that your RG flows not to this KPZ fixed point, but it actually flows to the Gaussian fixed points, which means that we are again back to equilibrium. And perhaps if we can modify this anisotropy in some interesting way, we can actually tune the system to be between a kind of equilibrium physics-dominated regime to this non-equilibrium physics-dominated regime. So how to realize this experiment? Surely creating a sample which will have such a different mass in one direction than in the other direction is not really feasible, but there are other ways. And this other way, which I will focus here, is it's so-called optical parametric oscillator, an OPO. So what is OPO? So that's another way of driving the cavity. Yeah. So instead of putting my drive up there and creating hot electron-hole pairs, which need to find their way down to the bottom of the polariton dispersion, you can just drive here at this inflection point of the polariton dispersion. So you put a laser at a given energy and given momentum with respect to this dispersion here. And now two polaritons collide, and they scatter. One scatters to the signal state here on the bottom of the dispersion, and one scatters to the idler state. Yeah? So if you want, in terms of the equations, you have your exciton and photon here. There is exciton-exciton interaction, exciton-photon interaction between here. And then you have your coherent drive, completely coherent drive. And this is a bath for the dissipation. You always have to have two baths. Yeah? So this is my coherent drive and my dissipation. Of course, the occupation would be non-thermal. I mean, this by eyes looks not thermal. However, there is a one-phase freedom. So the sum of the signal and idler phases is fixed by the pump, but the difference is completely free. So you have one free phase in the system. And this means that you have spontaneous U1 symmetry breaking and gapless and diffusive Gaussian mode. So apart from this non-thermal occupation, this system is exactly the same as any other type of condensate with spontaneous symmetry breaking. Moreover, and it might be of interest to this audience, and it was pointed out to me by Ehud and Lucas, is that this is the time crystal. Yeah. So if you drive this with some periods with some frequency omega p, and then you get like three largely occupied state, signal pump and idler. So now if you calculate the total occupation of the polaritons at the position R and T, you have stripes, yeah, because you would have some kind of interference between pump, signal and idler, you get stripes. And so the system will repeat itself after two times the period, if you look at here. So it's really a time crystal. Of course, the OPO is an extremely old concept. And people are studying it for years without ever naming it a time crystal. But since the time crystals are so popular nowadays, it's worth mentioning. We won't use it anything in what I'm going to talk later, but it is a time crystal. Now, what you do in experiment, you don't really look at this whole emission. The whole emission will have stripes, and the vortex will be a dislocation in this stripe. But instead, what usually is done in experiment, people are not interested in pump and idler. They just filter it out, and you only look at the signal. And then if you have a vortex state in the signal, it will just look as a normal vortex. So that's the system what we'll be working with. So now let's see. So before, before looking at KPZ of that OPO, I just mentioned the numerical results because this we've done it some years ago already, so it was older than the previous work, and it's quite instructive. So if now I write a very similar equation to what Sebastian was describing, but now in this OPO context, so I have to have explicitly exciton and photons. I don't have just one bosonic mode. I have to have two interacting via exciton interaction and then exciton-photon interaction. Then I have my drive here and my noise term. So you can derive this two different ways. Either, and that's what's my favorite, either you just write the Keldysh field theory and then map it. I only have three letters here. I hope I'll be okay. By the same formalism, you can map the action to the stochastic equation. Or you can write the Fokker-Planck equation and truncate it at the second order. And instead of making approximations that what Sebastian was presenting means that you make approximation to the second order in amplitude, and then you take all orders in phase, and you only look at phase dynamics, you can just take a brute force and just solve it numerically. Then you include everything. You include all kinds of fluctuations in your system. You include vortices, you include amplitude fluctuation, and of course the dominant phase fluctuations. What you see for this OPO systems with some realistic experimental choice of parameters, you see that as you increase the density in your system, you're really getting something like the BKT transition. So at low densities, you have a lot of free vortex, anti-vortex pairs, and then they actually free vortices and anti-vortices, then they start binding, and then as you increase density even more, you finally have only tightly bound vortex-anti-vortex pairs, or even no vortices at all. and going from exponential to algebraic order. So I just go quickly because it's very similar to the incoherently pumped case, with a difference, with one difference. So it fits the power law, it fits algebraic decay, but with much larger the exponent. So so we can get exponents larger than 1/4. And you can do these calculations for very large systems. We run, this picture shows up to 500 microns, but we even run up to 1,000 microns. A current experiment, the upper bound is 100 microns. So we can essentially run 10 times the current experiment. And we are seeing this only this equilibrium-like PKT behavior, just with modified exponent. One can do quenches, yeah, so to confirm that it's consistent what we are seeing with a kind of more equilibrium-like, or to look for these differences, we can also do quenches across the transition, and that gives us the critical exponent of the of z equal 2. So if you do quench and you observe how vortices decay in time, as in the usual phase ordering type of behavior, and look at the correlation function, then you collapse your correlation function so you can get your characteristic length as a function of time, you can fit those exponents and you can get that z is equal to 2, which is basically like equilibrium XY model, which is basically means that you have the equilibrium PKT. How much time do I have here? Yeah, so this system, even in this equilibrium part, it's quite interesting, it's multi-component. I'll maybe go quickly over that because I want to reach, and it's spinor. So the excitons have plus minus one spin, and there is a polarization of light. Because of some technical part of the semiconductor physics, you can actually have spin orbit coupling in the system. And because of the TM-TM, so basically there is a different refractive index for different polarization of light. So it's quite a complicated spin system in which you can inject full vortices, fractional vortices. I will just advertise this quickly as I don't have time to talk about that part, but it's going to be published soon in the journal when you can introduce skirmions and spin vortices, and because of the spin orbit coupling, it actually leads to a very complicated and quite interesting dynamics, spin separation in the system. But going back to our OPO, so numerics is exact, but it's finite. Yeah, so you only can look at finite system in numerics. Even if it's 10 times larger than experiment, it doesn't matter. It's a finite size system. Perhaps the experiments are just still too small to see some of the effects. So what we wanted to see is that if we now look at this OPO, but analytically, so we can look at infinite size limits and to see whether the reason we were only seeing BKT type of quasi-equilibrium regime was because indeed we are hitting this so much anisotropic regime that we are already going to like Gaussian fixed point, that even if we had infinite system that would give us algebraic decay, or perhaps we're just limited by the finite size. So one can follow a similar path looking at phase fluctuations to all orders, but now with a slightly more complicated system of the OPO where you have three components because you have a signal, pump, and idler. So when you develop your Keldysh field theory, you have to account for all of these three different fields. So you have three of those, Keldysh and classical, I mean quantum and classical, and the particle Hall. So it's a 12-dimensional problem, but that's okay. I mean, one can do it. The big point here is that the dispersion is not quadratic and is anisotropic. Yeah, so that's where anisotropy comes from here in this dispersion. So if you look at the mean field phase diagram for the OPO, you will see that you have this green region where you have, in the white region, you just have a pump state. So you just pump and your polaritons are where they are. That this OPO process is not happening. In this pink region, OPO process is happening, and in the green region, it's happening in a simple way. So you have pump, signal, and idler. In this pink region, which is outside of the green region, means that you have more complicated OPO. It's still an OPO, but it might happen that you have a satellite state, or it might happen that you have an OPO on the ring, or you have some pattern formation in the system. So it's more complicated. It's not that it's less interesting, but it's much more difficult to look at. So we focus only on these green areas. And one can derive equation for the phase in this OPO limit. And we find that it's of the KPZ type. Yeah, so you have the usual bits, you have the nonlinear bit, but you have also the drift term. But drift term coming from the fact that your signal is not at the zero momentum. The drift term can be eliminated. You can always move to the frame of reference with the drift, and then you can map the problem exactly to the KPZ-like story with these two fixed point, the Gaussian fixed point, and the KPZ fixed point, depending where you are with anisotropy. So here is anisotropy. The drift term will have almost no influence, but not fully no influence, because if you compute now time correlations, it actually will appear, so it will not appear in space correlations, but it will appear in time correlation. And it means that at shorter time, it will be like in the KPZ scenario, but at the longer time, you have actually faster temporal decay at longer time because of this drift term. So that's basically the only influence of the drift term. Otherwise, it's a very similar behavior to KPZ. So now let's look at, we take some, again, experimentally relevant numbers. And as you, and let's say I look at here in this region of my OPO, so as I increase my drive, I'm going towards the phase transitions. I'm going towards switching off the OPO. So it's a little bit counterintuitive, because as you increase the drive, you are coming closer to the phase transition. So what we can see, this is a phase diagram as a function of anisotropy and this noise parameter. And the arrows indicate as I'm increasing the drive. So now, depending on the detuning between exciton and photon, and this can be changed very easily. So both the drive can be changed very easily in the experiment, and also the detuning between exciton and photon can be changed very easily, because the sample is grown on a wedge. So as you change position in space, you can change your detuning between exciton and photon. Yeah, so if I pick up some detuning here, like let's say I pick up one point on the sample, and then I increase my drive, I can go between this isotropic universality class, so KPZ universality class, and as I cross zero, so zero is a critical point. If I go to negative anisotropy, and then my system goes to the Gaussian fixed point in the RG sense, so it will be like an equilibrium. So by increasing, now I increase the drive, and I go from non-equilibrium-like behavior to equilibrium-like behavior. And in this case, in the green case, I go from one type of disorder, these disorders can be different, but one type of disorder, to another type of disorder. But if I change my detuning to blue, I can go from disorder phase to order phase, so algebraically order phase, and then again to disorder phase. I have re-entrance phase diagram. I can go between one type of disorder to another type of disorder to order, and again out of the disorder. So it's quite interesting. I mean, this region is governed by the equilibrium-like physics, so this phase transition is just BKT transition, but here, this is non-equilibrium, governed by non-equilibrium fixed point, and I can go between one and the other as I change my drive. Yeah, so it all looks very exciting, but now let's put finite size on that system, because we know that if my system is just too small, if the system is smaller than the length scale for the KPZ or length scale for vortices, of course I'm not going to see any of this behavior. So if I put, that's just a remark that you can change anisotropy in two ways. One way is changing the detuning, and another way is to changing your Kp, so you change Ks. So if I change the angle of the pump, then I change my momentum of my signal, and I can also go through anisotropic regime. Yeah, so that's a two practical way to do it. But unfortunately, when I put a finite size in a kind of typical microcavities, which are studied today, it doesn't look so promising, because the length scale for which, so this LV, which Sebastian was talking about, is quite large. Yeah, so this is a typical microcavity, not the best microcavity, but the kind of typical which most groups have. And then if I go on this line, so this is a system size, and this is a drive. I'm changing the drive here. So it really looks that I can only have a BKT transition. So I go from algebraically ordered to disorder. It would really be nice to be here, so to be in this kind of unusual disorder phase, the one governed by the KPZ, and then go to algebraically order and then to disorder again. But at the moment, this is, you need meter, you need a system of the size of the meters if you work with current cavities. But one has to remember that those cavities were optimized to go to equilibrium. That was the holy grail in the community. Everyone was trying to get the best quality samples from the point of view of lifetime and interactions. So now we would need samples which are still good quality from the point of disorder and inhomogeneous broadening in the system, but a short lifetime. Yeah. So that's probably where we have to look if we want to observe that. However, there is one other promising phase, and that's what we found. So now, if you look at this OPO phase diagram, we found that in the middle of this phase diagram, there is quite an interesting regime where we found that G is larger than one. G is the parameter which is governing the KPZ nonlinearity. And this means that in this regime, actually, the KPZ should appear at all length scales. And whether this is an artifact is not a mistake. Yes, yeah? So I think both Lucas and Alex got exactly the same answer, working independently. So it's not a mistake, but here there is another phase coming up. Yeah, because as I said, there is a pattern formation forming. So your OPO is not going to be just signal pump and idler, so three simple states, but it's going to form more spatial structure. And perhaps this KPZ physics will be now killed by this pattern formation and the kind of spatial, by the amplitude fluctuations. So to conclude, very shortly, so in the last 2-3 years, microcavities in which fully equilibrium condensation and superfluidity and the BKT phase transition has been realized. So it's only in the last few years that was possible. And now this system can perhaps be used since one can create lattices there, since it's a spinor system with spin orbit coupling and so on and so forth. One can use that to look at equilibrium phenomena and quantum simulator for other systems which are less known. But you would also now, since this has been achieved and the box is ticked, it would be nice to move to look at these intrinsically non-equilibrium features which are not present in equilibrium. But for that, we actually have to look at systems with worse lifetime, which was overlooked so far because no one was interested in this type of phenomena. And especially if you combine anisotropy with dissipation, one can go between different phases, some of them which are possible in equilibrium, some which are not. So current samples are probably not the best, although if you make use of the OPO, so if you make use of this anisotropy, it is actually showing the promising regimes which could still be destroyed by competition with other phases, but it's something to look into. Yeah. Thank you.
Possible to have a finite momentum compensation if you add spin orbit coupling. Spin orbit coupling usually splits the bands such that the minimum is no longer q equals zero. So have people discussed anything like
yeah,
that?
Yes, so I don't think people discuss in terms of spin orbit coupling. I mean, there was a finite momentum condensation in here because if you, let's say in OPO, you can move your
OPO, I'm sorry.
So it's historically taken from optics, it's optical parametric oscillator.
Oh, okay.
But here is just a name. It's basically, it means that you pump, you inject the polaritons at one momentum, so they have finite momentum, but then they scatter to these two momentum states, but still with a phase freedom, so you have a condensate. But by changing the Kp and omega p, so the frequency and momentum of your drive, you can actually make your condensate not exactly at k equals zero, but at a finite k. So in this sense, it has been realized. I don't think people used spin orbit coupling for that. Spin orbit coupling can be, because spin orbit coupling you can't really control that well. I mean, you have your sample and it has a spin orbit coupling because of this semiconductor physics. and people use it to look at behavior of spin vortices and how these vortices can be affected by that.
So the reason I'm asking is because in cold atoms, mm-hmm. people have realized sort of a synthetic spin orbit coupling, and one of the interesting features there is that, well, if you have spin orbit coupling, for instance, Rajboff, so you have a minimum that is no longer at Q equals zero, but it's on a ring in momentum space, so which gives you degeneracy and some interesting physics. So here, for example, if you were to have something like that.
I don't think anyone looked at how spin orbit coupling can.
In any case, let's thank.